I'm Elisa Opar. I'm the articles editor at Audubon Magazine. And with me today, discussing gene drive technology, I have Kevin Esfeld, the leader of the Sculpting Evolution Group at the MIT Media Lab. We've got Todd Kuchen, senior research scholar, at the Genetic Engineering and Society Center at North Carolina State University, and Brooke Burrell, journalist and author, who has written extensively about biotech. So I'm going to have Kevin go ahead and start things off today and give everyone an overview of this technology that we're talking about.
All right. Thank you, Elisa. So much has been said about CRISPR in particular, but what does that have to do with gene drive, and what is a gene drive, for that matter? So to give the technical definition, a gene drive is any vertically transmitted, that is, parents to offspring, genetic element that will reliably increase in frequency in a population over time, even if it doesn't help organisms reproduce. And it can only do that by somehow stacking the deck in its favor. Now, CRISPR comes in because even though gene drive is a ubiquitous phenomenon in nature, with CRISPR, we now have the potential ability to harness it in order to spread engineered changes through even wild populations. So how does it work? If you have an organism here, let's say an invasive mouse, and you introduce into it DNA into the germline, the cells that will give rise to sperm and eggs, that encodes not just your desired change there in the middle, but also encodes the CRISPR system to make that change. Now, CRISPR is a molecular scalpel that we can program to cut and therefore edit any sequence in the genome of just about any organism. So here we have this DNA that encodes the instructions for cutting the wild genome at a particular point. So CRISPR will then find that exact sequence and cut it, and then the cell will repair the damage by incorporating the new sequence. But now what's unique about this, and very different from standard CRISPR genome editing, is that now this cell encodes CRISPR itself and the instructions telling it where to cut. So this cell now will keep producing CRISPR. It will cut the other chromosome and copy itself over. So what gets really interesting is when this organism mates, because now note that it has two copies of the edited version. That means all of the offspring will inherit the edited version. And in those offspring, editing happens again. It cuts the original version and replaces it with the edited one. Meaning, in the next generation, all the offspring are guaranteed to inherit. And again, and again, and again. Every time the CRISPR-based gene drive system encounters the wild version, it will replace it with itself. And so eventually you theoretically convert the entire population. Now, why is this relevant to conservation? Well, there are a number of reasons, but the most obvious is if this is an invasive rodent, a mouse or especially a rat, imagine what would happen if we said, included instructions that said all of these organisms will now be males. This population will not be long for this world. What if we said instead that, say, anyone who inherits two copies, one from both parent, will be sterile? Same outcome. It spreads rapidly when rare. Because if you inherit one copy, you're fine. But as soon as it's very common, you get a lot of organisms that are suddenly sterile. Population crashes, potentially goes away. Note that the advantage of this is it would be completely humane. That is, no organisms suffer. There's no poison. There's no traps. There's no anything like that. They just stop reproducing. So when I first described the potential for this technology, which we published in papers in eLife and Science, I had this diagram, which was very optimistic. And this is now perhaps my greatest regret, because it is completely and utterly wrong. There are a few applications for this form of gene drive that I described, but it's not most of the things on this list. And you'll note that environment, aiding threatened species and controlling invasive species, sustainable pest management, these were all things that were on the original version. That's what I think now. Not because on a technical level you could not do all of these things, but just because when you take into account diplomatic and social barriers and just the wisdom of introducing a technology that is anticipated to spread indefinitely through a population, it means that most of these things are just no longer a good idea. And how invasive is this then? Because if you're combating an invasive species, you should be very careful to ensure that your technology isn't equivalently invasive and potentially causing a problem elsewhere. That is, you may want to solve the local problem of this invasive species, but that species is native to somewhere else. So we did some modeling. This is led by a grad student, Chuck Noble at Harvard, and Martin Novak's group. And it has five populations, assumes 500 individuals per population. They're assumed to be mice or rats. And if you introduce the gene drive into just one, then what happens? Well, this is the worst possible gene drive system. That is the worst that has been reported to work to date. So let's assume it's the worst one. And we find that at very low migration rates, one organism every couple of generations is enough to ensure that it spreads to all of those populations within 20 generations. And if you look at the characteristics of the drive system, how good is it at copying itself? That's on the left-hand side, versus the migration rate required to invade other populations. Any drive system that we might want to use in the wild is going to be up there towards 0.9 to 1 in terms of how good it is at copying itself. The versions in mosquitoes are at 0.98 at the very, very top. At that level of efficiency, a migration rate of one organism every 100,000 is enough to invade. It literally takes a handful of organisms introduced into a new population for the gene drive system to spread. And as we all know, rats are really good stowaways. So this standard version of gene drive, that the one that I showed you, that has everything it needs to copy itself, is probably too invasive to be practical for conservation. Not universally. There may be some ways of specifically targeting sequences only found in a particular invasive population. Maybe. But they're so likely to spread beyond field trial sites, you probably cannot even run a field trial of this safely. It is likely to spread, just as you can't really run a field trial of biocontrol, the traditional form. And if you look at history, if species offer people an economic benefit, they will move them. New Zealand has the tightest biocontrol in the world. It did not help when New Zealand farmers wanted to import Khaleesi virus to take out their invasive rabbit population. Rabbits do about $50 million in damages every year to New Zealand, economically speaking. The rat does over $20 billion to the United States alone. If you build a suppression drive for conservation that would affect the rat, and it would work in North America, someone would move it. So how can you fix this? Well, my group is working on a way of building a drive system that would only work in a local population by making it dependent on a form of genetic fuel. So we call this a daisy drive because it involves creating a daisy chain of genetic elements. And basically, we just want to separate the components. So now you have the instructions on C that causes B to be copied, instructions on B that cause A to be copied. A actually encodes the change you want to spread. So what's interesting about this is that C is a normal engineered gene. Nothing causes C to be copied. But while C is around, it increases B. While B is around, it increases A. And that's important because anything we do is eventually going to be driven down and go away because natural selection opposes us, especially if we're doing things like spreading infertility. So it's inherently local, but we can control the power by adding more links to the chain because every link in the daisy chain is like a form of genetic fuel. And so it's predicted to spread further because it loses elements one by one the more links you have. So we can tune the power of this. If this works, and I emphasize if, because we have some preliminary data in the laboratory, but it's very preliminary, and there are a lot of things and safeguards that we would have to take, tests would we have to examine, to make sure that this thing would not evolve in unexpected ways. Because we have no experience engineering systems that are anticipated to evolve outside of our control. So we need to be very careful in moving forwards, and I hesitate even to suggest this, other than the fact that there is a great deal of excitement about the possibility of new tools for conservation. And here I've just totally thrown water on the one that everyone got really excited about. I think there is potential in these local versions, but again, it is very early days. That said, I think it's very important to begin discussions of new technologies in the earliest stages. So my group is working on a couple of other projects that don't relate to gene drives, but do involve ecological engineering. This one is driven by the communities of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, and they're interested in immunizing the white-footed mice that infect most ticks with Lyme disease and other pathogens. And it would involve releasing engineered mice, 100% mouse still, because that's the way the communities wanted it, onto the islands and then to disrupt the transmission cycle. And the communities are in charge. We haven't even made the mice yet, but they told us what kind of mice they want to make, how they want it to be tested and everything. The community is in the driver's seat. I think that's the way it has to be. Recently, I went to Aotearoa, to New Zealand, to discuss the possibility of developing Daisy Drive in rodents and asking for their guidance as we began doing this. And happily, some Maori environmental leaders have offered to essentially take the lead in locally guiding that discussion and telling us what to do. Because again, we will be the technical hands, and it will be the people there who will be telling us what we should be doing. And I think that's especially important that we harness the place-centric knowledge of indigenous communities and traditions that frankly think about problems in more of an intuitive, one might say, if Dan Kahneman might say, system one level thinking, whereas most of our reductionist science is very system two logical and doesn't deal as well with complex systems. So I'm interested in ensuring that these technologies, which are, we believe, very powerful, are used wisely, because just because we have the knowledge to build them doesn't mean that we have the knowledge to use them responsibly. So above all, I think my challenge for everyone, especially in this room, given that you are all journalists, is whenever you hear of anyone developing a technology that is intended to be used for ecological engineering, just remember that it's fundamentally different from that of pretty much any other technology, because you can choose not to use an iPhone. But you can't choose not to breathe the air or drink the water. You can't opt out of ecological engineering. And that means that if we do this behind closed doors, and make no mistake, almost all of science is done behind closed doors until the paper is published, then you're denying people a voice in decisions that will affect them. And I don't think that's right. So whenever you hear of a project that it will affect the shared environment, then please ask some hard questions about why they weren't open about that from the very beginning. Thanks.
Here you go. All right. So good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. So I'm going to try to talk about some of the broader issues around governance and also some of the ethical questions that are sort of floating around with the technologies that Kevin was discussing. And I may come across as a little provocative, and that's kind of on purpose to try to get the sort of a broader conversation started. But I want to start with some disclosures about myself first, to sort of in this openness theme that we're talking about. So one is I've worked at and I support environmental activist groups, some that have in the past or now are sort of against these types of technologies. But I also am currently working with groups that are actually developing gene drives for conservation. So you can start already to begin to see some of the contradictions that I even have in myself about these technologies, which is what I'm saying there. That is, I'm still conflicted about just the notion of utilizing gene drives for conservation, this idea of taking a species that we either want to eliminate or even taking a species that we want to save and using something like a gene drive to accomplish that, in essence, goes against a lot of the way that I think many of us were trained. So I'm an environmental scientist by training. So this notion of this kind of interjection into a species makes our head spin a little bit. And then finally, you can actually read about this confliction. I've tried to sort of write it down in this book here that Kevin has a chapter in as well. So now that that's out of the way, a lot of this, though, some of this is sort of what's old is new again in a way, particularly in the environmental world and particularly the conservation world. So in the past, when you started to see the sort of initial rise of what some would consider sort of the eco-radical groups, so groups like Earth First, for instance, those sort of came about with a dissatisfaction with the sort of mainstream conservation groups in terms of actually producing results, in terms of actually saving species or actually preventing environmental damage. And you began to see this splintering of groups that wanted to take a very different and radical path path to sort of reach those goals that, in essence, everyone had the same goal of, which was sort of environmental protection and environmental conservation. And I would argue we're beginning to see sort of a similar kind of split, potentially, in the conservation world as we're beginning to get more tools in the toolbox for conservation, and gene drives being one of those. And so these are just a handful of some of them. So this is one of these is Kevin's group that I would put in as a conservationist. As you listen to sort of what his goals are in terms of developing these gene drives, I would say is exactly what the conservation community is also trying to accomplish. Island Conservation is the group that I work with at NC State. So they are interested in looking at gene drives, particularly for daughterless mouse. For daughterless mice, which are a huge problem on islands as an invasive species that eventually are killing off most of the native bird populations. Revive and Restore is a group that's interested in de-extinction, so you've probably read about that in the press. And Conservation X Labs is an interesting organization that's really more looking at sort of how conservation is funded and how technology is developed specifically for conservation purposes. You don't necessarily have to read all of this, so this is sort of a thought experiment in a bit in terms of how these technologies also might be used in a different form of environmental activism. So I'll give you a second to read this, but this is an idea of whether you could actually release a gene drive using bird seeds. So the gene drive would be, in essence, embedded into seed. The birds would then take up, and then it would be, in essence, spread across different fields. The idea being that then the flowers that resulted from that, if they were on a particular piece of land that was contaminated, would sort of glow, or not glow, but would turn blue. So this was a thought experiment, but this was actually developed by a design school that was part of the BioDesign Challenge, which is a competition where design students are paired up with scientists and synthetic biologists to think about what a potential futures might look like using some of these technologies. And this was one that was envisioned in the year 2029 in post-Brexit Europe, which now would allow genetic engineering and these technologies being in the hands of, say, a potential environmental activist. So this is obviously theoretical, but it's just another way for us to kind of think about this. So I've also sort of been part of the sort of hype cycle around these things and putting out salacious headlines sometimes. But while the headline is a little salacious, I think this question about the military's funding in this space is important, particularly from not just an ethical standpoint, but also whether or not you would be able to actually utilize these technologies. There's a lot of work being done around gene drive technology for the eradication of malaria, and I think we need to think about who's funding some of that work and whether or not the funding mechanisms for that would reduce the impact of being able to utilize some of those technologies, particularly if they're being utilized in countries outside of the United States. Because as far as I know, and Kevin, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, the military right now is the only one who's funding the safety mechanisms of gene drives. So as a researcher, your only option to actually develop some of these technologies responsibly in terms of safety is to go after DARPA money from the U.S. military. So that's another sort of question, I think, that needs to be discussed more broadly in the public. And so then where is this debate about sort of whether or not we can even utilize these gene drives? So this is happening in multiple international fronts currently as we speak. So at the IUCN's World Congress in December, they developed this statement, in essence, requiring IUCN to do a scoping study about gene drives and other genetic technologies and whether or not it's something that should be utilized in the conservation field. This is also currently being discussed within the Convention on Biological Diversity. So I sit on the ATAG, which is just an ad hoc expert group inside the CBD, where we've been discussing synthetic biology for a number of years now. These are the four topics that have been discussed in an open online forum for over the summer. We're going to be meeting in December to try to work through all of that information and see, in essence, what's real, what's not. And eventually, develop some recommendations for the Secretariat in terms of how this particular treaty will deal with not just gene drives, but some of these new genetic technologies in general. So this is, I think, for me anyway, and I think also for a lot inside the conservation community, or is really one of the questions or the ethical questions that we're asking ourselves, or one that's hard for myself anyway to get past, which is, if we resign ourselves to this notion that we have to use a gene drive to save a particular species, we're in essence admitting defeat. Right, that we've failed, as I would argue, as a society, for saving those species in a more practical, sort of realistic way. That we've gotten to this point where we have to now reach towards these, I would argue, sort of extreme tools in order to actually then save those species. But you could also flip that and think about it another way. As humans are part of the environment, we are part of the world. And so our ability to develop these types of technologies could just be part of the natural evolution of the planet. And if we're able to do that, why wouldn't we utilize that kind of knowledge and that kind of technologies to save a species, for instance? That's sort of two of the main ways that I've been thinking about it. But I think I'll leave you with this, which is really, you know, I think the question that people are struggling with from an ethical standpoint is, you know, do we as humans really have the right to do this? Do we have the right to permanently alter a species' genetic makeup forever in order to save it, or in order to remove one species from one area that we don't want it, or that we don't think it should be there, or that we want to remove it from an area because we made the mistake of allowing it to get there in the first place? But then I think if the answer to that question is yes, then how do we actually evaluate when to utilize this? And right now, the governance systems that are available to us are still lacking in terms of when you could be able to utilize something like a gene drive. Where do you field test a gene drive? There are not many, if any, real good field trial sites to actually do a field trial that you would need for a gene drive, because after all, you're not going to know what it does until you actually release it. So doing a controlled field trial on a technology that's designed to move, right? It doesn't work if it doesn't move, is a tricky business that also needs to be worked out. And then there's the added bonus of the international piece to this, where a gene drive is not going to stop at a particular country's borders. So how do we deal with a situation if country X decides to use it, but country Y doesn't want it? So that I will end or be quiet.
I don't have any slides. Sorry for that, or maybe not. I don't know. So Elisa asked me to talk briefly about some of the coverage I've done on gene drives and talk about some of the challenges in covering this technology. So briefly, I've been writing about biotech for many years. More recently, obviously, with the advent of CRISPR, a lot of that coverage has focused on that. And now that CRISPR has enabled gene drives, I have been writing about gene drives. So three of the main stories I just wanted to mention, because I think they get at in different ways the challenges in covering this technology. The first was a piece I actually did for Audubon about the island conservation group that Todd mentioned, that, just to reiterate, they are looking at different ways to use gene drive to reduce invasive mice, specifically on islands, to protect seabirds and other wildlife. It's very far from actually getting to the point where they're going to release these things. It's early stages, but that's the general hope, because right now their only way to control these rodents is with rodenticide, which is a gruesome death for the animals involved, and also obviously can have some off-target effects on the other wildlife on islands. And that story also got at this sort of split that we're seeing in the conservation movement that Todd also just mentioned, between different groups who have the same goal of conservation, but some really don't want to use gene drive at all, and some are a little bit more open-minded to it. So that story gets at that a bit. I also have a piece that's in the current issue of Scientific American that talks more about this trend, if you can call it that. It's still a relatively small group that is actually doing gene drive research, but within that small group, there does seem to be this trend of these groups reaching out to the public and doing a lot of public engagement very early on, which to me seems so different than the early days of GMOs, where you have companies like Monsanto creating a product that they saw as a need and then just sort of dropping it on the public without a lot of interaction. Of course, we could talk about the differences between a private company and how they're going to act versus publicly or nonprofit-funded research and how they might interact in those ways as well. It's a different thing. But there is this trend to sort of reach out to the public much earlier in the research with gene drives. Kevin is sort of on the more extreme side of that, I would actually argue, in going and talking to some of these communities even before the research starts. So that's what that piece is about. And then finally, I had a piece that came out last year in Quanta magazine that later got syndicated at The Atlantic. And this was about one of the many technical challenges of creating a gene drive, because, of course, this is a new technology. There are a lot of, you know, there's a lot to be done, I think, in trying to understand how these work and getting them to actually work in practice. They have gotten them to work, of course, in the lab in critters like mosquitoes and fruit flies and yeast, but that's a long way from doing that in an actual mammal, right? But in that particular piece, I was talking about one technical challenge, which is resistance. Every time that we have a technology where we're trying to control nature in some way, whether we're talking about antibiotics or talking about pesticides, usually there is some sort of resistance that happens, and that is something that may happen with, you know, tinkering with genes as well. And I actually haven't followed up on that particular research, so maybe we can talk more about where that is at this time. I'm not sure. So in talking about some of the challenges in covering a technology like this that's very fast-moving and in early days and also very controversial, a few things came to mind. I'm sure you'll have more questions and we can talk about other aspects as well. But one, I think that people are rightfully concerned about this technology for reasons that have already come up. This is something that in some ways is unprecedented. Of course, we've had other technologies in the past that have the possibility to alter our shared environments, but this is something that is actually designed to spread in a way that we haven't seen before. And this can cross borders, this can, you know, alter ecosystems where people didn't have a say, and there could be some outcomes that we really aren't sure what's going to happen, right? So I think that people are rightfully concerned, so getting that into stories I think is really important. But on the flip side of that, I also think one of the challenges has been not to be too alarmist about this, because you do have a lot of, there's the people who are involved in this research are thinking about a lot of these ethical dimensions in the same way that we are. And I think that covering that honestly and not acting like it's a bunch of evil scientists in their lab trying to change our environment, like, that's not really the right narrative either. So being honest and open and not alarmist about what's actually happening in these labs and in this research. And then finally, just navigating the different language that is used has been interesting to me, and making sure I understand. It can be very illuminating to the different perspectives people have on this technology. For example, the project that Island Conservation is doing, it's part of a consortium of several universities and other research groups, and they're called GBIRD, which stands for Genetic Biocontrol of Invasive Rodents. It sounds like something out of The Princess Bride or something. But they use that word biocontrol to describe this technology, and biocontrol more conventionally refers to using some natural predator, some other natural organism that you already know that it goes after a certain other organism and so on and so forth. It's sort of talking about some natural interaction that already exists, whereas we're talking about actually going in and changing the genetics of an entire wild population, which I would say is different. And I feel a little uneasy using biocontrol in that way. It means something different to me. On the flip side of that, you have groups like Friends of the Earth who are using words like, they call it genetic extinction technology, which is on the other extreme, and I also don't think that's really a fair way to describe this technology. A gene drive isn't one single thing. There are many different ways to do it. There are the more localized gene drives that Kevin talked about. There are more global gene drives. So describing it as an extinction technology isn't quite right either. It's a lot more nuanced than that. And that's all I have for now. And did you have... And that's it.
And Brooke is done, people. I think, you know, one of the things that that I wanted to ask you all about is just the fact that this technology, I mean, CRISPR is fast, it's cheap, it has spread, it's being used widely. And because it is so powerful, it has spurred some calls to either ban all research until regulations are in place, or less drastic drastically to not release any, you know, gene drive organisms into the wild until those regulations are in place. Is that possible? Are we going to get those regulations in place before we're going to stop research or? I mean, I think that effectively is a ban, right? I think the idea, even with, you know, the genetic technologies we've had for decades at this point, the world has not yet had some sort of cohesive regulatory policy on those. I think the idea of having some sort of agreement policy-wise worldwide is basically a way to say we're not going to use this technology at all.
Yeah, I'll take a positive spin on that in a way. I think we have an opportunity to get the governance systems right on this because the technology is still in the very early stages of it. I would say beyond sort of an accidental release of one of these lower, like an insect out of a lab, we're still pretty far away from getting it into, say, a mouse or it working inside of a mouse. And so I think there's time and there is a lot of work going on both in individual countries and also at the international level to try to figure out what does a governance structure look like to in essence, govern the release of a gene drive organism into the environment.
Whereas I view it as more of an opportunity to change how we do science. Because to me, the fact that we never imagined we could edit an entire species 5 years ago, like the concept isn't even in science fiction. I mean, I'm a huge science fiction fan. I've never seen it. I've asked every science fiction author I've met, no one has. The closest thing is probably Vonnegut's Ice Nine, but that's not exactly a species. So here you have this technology that, and it's largely because of CRISPR, but then CRISPR, again, can be harnessed for gene drive, that we didn't see coming. And I want to emphasize, this is not particularly dangerous technology. That is, if I put on my black hat, this is slow because it only spreads over generations. It's unfailingly obvious. That is, if you sequence a genome, you cannot miss it. You will see it. And once you see it, you can build the counter because anything you can find and replace, somebody else can find and replace back. So because of those things, it's not particularly dangerous, but that's sheer luck, right? That it happened to have those traits. It's not something that we chose. It just happened to be that this particular technological box that we opened wasn't very dangerous. But what safeguards do we have to ensure that the next one isn't? Why do we do most research in small groups of similarly trained specialists who can't reliably anticipate the broader consequences? That seems very foolish. Gene drive is an example. It should be a warning flag that says we should change how we do science because, furthermore, in ecological engineering, who says we have the right, as Todd's slide said, who says we have the right to do this research in the first place when the goal is to change the whole world in ways that people can't opt out of, unlike most other technologies? Isn't that a call to change how we do science for that reason, which then maybe could allow us to make wiser decisions and maybe give the policymakers some warning? Because let me tell you, I've been talking to policymakers about gene drive since 2014, and I think two countries have done anything at all. Yeah. And the tech on, we say that CRISPR time runs differently from normal time. Yeah, policymakers have no hope. Regulators are not going to help. Technology's too fast. So we need to give us as much time as possible before the technology is developed so that we can see what is coming as best we can and do our best to make wise decisions.
What are those two countries?
The Netherlands and Germany. There's another couple that have done recommendations, but yeah.
Going back to what you were saying about danger, James Clapper, the former U.S. Director of National Intelligence last year.
I took that slide out because I didn't think we should talk about it.
You want to take cover? Yeah, he listed gene editing as a possible weapon of mass destruction. So I'm wondering, I mean, Kevin, I'd like to get your take on that and others as well, just what that listing, you know, is this hyperbole? What is it? And what does that mean for uses of this technology for something like conservation?
I don't think it helped. And from my speaking with people, so I was still in D.C. at the time when that came out, and from what I understand, that was a bit of a surprise to other people in the government that statement was put in there. But at the same time, you know, it, I don't know. I don't know why exactly that was put in there. But if you then look at that statement and then you look at, say, the funding trajectory of particularly organizations like DARPA, then maybe they do believe that this is sort of that severe because of the amount of money that they're putting into programs around gene drives and around their Insect Allies program and around their Ecological Niche Preferences program. So they obviously see it as some potential threat. But in terms of sort of a weapon of mass destruction, I think, I mean, Kevin explained this really well, is that there's a lot easier ways to cause a lot of damage than relying on a gene drive to do some ecological damage. You know, we've thought about it as a way from an agricultural standpoint, like if you wanted to cause some damage that way, you could release it into potentially an agricultural staple crop, and you could then, over time, see some damage from that. But there, I mean, not to bring up horrible things, but just last week we saw a way to cause a lot of damage really quickly with low tech. And so I don't see how gene drives could really be utilized in a way that would be classified as a weapon of mass destruction, but I'm also not a biosecurity expert.
Well, just to stamp out that one little fire that you ignited, Todd, the fact that almost all modern crops are hybrids means that the genetics have to be tightly controlled. You don't go farmer seed into next generation of crops anymore, which means that a gene drive, in order to spread through any major agricultural staple, would have to somehow infiltrate the seed farms whose genetics are monitored. So agriculture is basically immune to gene drive just because we already monitor the genetics, and because hybrids tend to have a yield advantage of about 10% or more in virtually all the staple crops. Every country in the world that isn't already at hybrid seed is moving in that direction. So global agriculture will be basically immune in the next few years, and the developed world already is. So, yeah.
I would just add, this is also kind of what I was getting at with not being alarmist about this technology and actually understanding how it works. I think that I did not cover that that listing of being a potential weapon of mass destruction, but I think that if you are covering that as a journalist, not just covering that at face value, but trying to put some context in there as to how likely it is, just because something ends up on a list, it doesn't mean that there aren't other concerns, which we're talking about, of course, and we can continue talking about, but putting that in context so that the readers don't freak out for no reason.
I'd like to take the opportunity to open up the floor to questions if anyone has them. And I'm supposed to remind you that it's SEJ members and journalists first. So,
hi, thank you. Could you provide a little bit more explanation on how the daisy chain works?
Sure, so more explanation on how the daisy chain works. So the problem with a standard CRISPR gene drive is it has everything it needs to copy itself. So the idea with DAISY is you break it up into multiple, you spread the instructions out over multiple different chromosomes. So chromosome C, say, has the guide RNAs that tell CRISPR to cut the wild type chromosome B. And that causes the instructions at B to be copied over. The instructions at B tell it to cut wild type chromosome A, which causes, say, the nuclease gene, the CRISPR nuclease that does the cutting, that gene and whatever change you want to make to be copied over. So when C is there, then B and A get copied. But there's nothing telling C to be copied. C is a normal engineered gene. And to the best of my knowledge, we do not have a single example of a case where any human-made alteration, and I'm including selective breeding here too, not just genome editing, no human genetic alteration has ever increased the fitness of an organism in its ancestral habitat. Ever. Meaning, in general, when we tweak something, as Darwin said, man selects for his own good, nature for that of the being which she tends. We're doing this typically for our benefit, not the organism's benefit. We're diverting its resources. And so that gene is going to be acted against by natural selection. So whatever we're doing, natural selection is going to slowly act to remove it. So I think of daisy drive, I took out the slides, maybe I should have left them in for additional explanatory. I think of it as a multi-stage genetic rocket, where every link in the daisy chain is like adding on another booster stage. It gives it a little bit more fuel, But natural selection is like gravity. It's dragging all the stages down. And as a stage effectively runs out of fuel, that's the fact that the one on the end isn't guaranteed inheritance. It's a normal engineered gene, and so natural selection will drag it down. And when it's gone, the next element loses its guarantee. Half of offspring no longer inherit it, and so on. And so it's a way of making the drive system inherently depend on a form of genetic fuel. And it can't just create more because there aren't guide RNAs out there like that. So, and it also doesn't rely on a kill switch, right? A lot of scientists seem to think that you can program an organism or a genetic element to die under certain conditions. But of course, you're working with evolution here. If you program it to die under certain conditions, then it's the one that acquired a mutation in your kill switch that's going to survive. And then you lose. So you can't rely on things like kill switches. You have to fundamentally arrange the architecture such that it needs something that is not there. So that's the idea of a daisy drive. But why do we need more testing and studies of this? Yes, it works on the exact same principles as the broader version that we know works in some organisms. But we also need to make sure that, for example, you don't get chromosomal rearrangements that move some of those things around. Is it stable over time? And how do you know that? Well, evolution is a numbers game. If you want to know what the odds are of winning the lottery and they haven't published it, the only way to find out is to buy enough tickets until you win. And in fact, you don't need to win several times. So how do we do that if we're looking at altering an entire wild population? The answer is you don't. You can't raise an equivalent number of mosquitoes in the lab as the number you might want to alter in the wild. So my group is working with nematode worms, these microscopic model organisms, just because we can grow billions of them in the lab. And so if we can engineer their genome to look like, say, that of a mosquito's, then we can build the mosquito daisy drive in the worms and then grow billions of them in the lab and under conditions where it will be blindingly obvious if even one of them switches over and behaves abnormally, we will see it. So that's the idea. Again, we're just making this up. Most of the questions have focused on, well, what about the environmental effects? Well, environmental effects are case by case. What we need to be asking is, what do we need to know about the fundamental technology? And yeah, that's a discussion we haven't really had yet.
And that paper hasn't been published yet.
All of our work, you can find it on BioArchive. That is, everything we do, think of, et cetera, we post it on BioArchive, and then we add updates over time. So,
you are next, I believe.
I'm John Manuel from North Carolina, and I've written in the past with great conviction about the need to preserve the wild red wolf population in the eastern part of the state. My understanding is now virtually all the wolves they've tested have a high percentage of coyote genes. So my first question would be, is it possible to back those genes out of a population? And now listening to you, my second question would be, do you even want to do that? given that natural selection seems to have steered them in that direction. First, is it possible?
No more of my field of expertise than yours.
Yeah, I don't know. So the question was whether you could, if you could back out the coyote genes out of the red wolves. And that I don't know. I would suggest you actually talk with the folks at Revive and Restore, because those are the experts who have been looking at those kinds of questions, and whether or not you could do that or not, or whether it would be a good idea.
Let's take the one in the back.
I'm Jesper from Oregon. This is relatively new for me, and so I'm curious about kind of the scope of what people think is possible with this. And it seems like all of the biological control examples you give are controlling one species to not affect another. And I'm wondering, what triggered this question is your statement that no human alteration has ever made a species more fit to survive. But I'm wondering if there's possibilities, like, say, in salmon, to make them resistant to warm water parasites that would make them better or fit in a climate change scenario. And I'm wondering if that is even in the scope of possibility, and if it is, then all of a sudden you are making them. And then how does
So the question concerns the scope of possibility of these technologies, especially given the potential to aid threatened species directly by making them genetically more fit, and is that not possible? So I chose my words very carefully on this one. I said, in the ancestral habitat, we have never seen that example. Whereas, of course, there's lots of documented cases of, say, herbicide-resistance genes from crops moving into wild weed relative species via hybridization, and that's strongly selected for because we're spraying herbicide everywhere. We've never seen any evidence that it helps otherwise. But similarly with climate change, the ancestral habitat very often doesn't exist anymore. Like, the degree of human impact on the world is such that conditions are often different, and so we may be able to help species gain an advantage. So one that we've just begun looking at, on the white-footed mice for tick-borne disease, the way we're looking at that, since the communities don't want us to use any non-mouse DNA, we are taking evolved antibody genes that individual mice have become resistant just through normal adaptive immunity, and we're looking at encoding those back into the germline so they can pass it on to their offspring. We could do a similar trick with the black-footed ferret using vaccinated ferrets. So the ferrets nearly went extinct. They're now at, I think, 4,000-ish individuals, something like that. But they're critically vulnerable to the Black Death. And Sylvatic plague is something that we seem to have introduced or otherwise caused to be more common. And so all the ferrets have to be vaccinated by a human in order to survive, which is obviously not very sustainable for the ferrets in the event that we go away. But here we could take ferret antibodies that provide resistance to Sylvatic plague, encode them in the ferret genome, and then that they would be resistant indefinitely. But you don't necessarily need a gene drive to do that. I mean, you can imagine doing the same sort of thing for bats and white nose or amphibians and chytrid and all that. But if you're giving them a major selective advantage, you don't necessarily need the gene drive. Natural selection will just ensure that the ones that are resistant do survive. Gene drive can get it there faster, but it's not, strictly speaking, necessary. So yes, I think that is absolutely a separate topic from gene drive, in that we will be able to use genetic technologies to aid species that are currently threatened by the myriad environmental changes that we've made, just because the environment isn't the ancestral habitat anymore.
We're going to go with the woman at the front table, and then you.
Yeah, so the question is sort of the, in essence, the democratization of CRISPR and these technologies sort of outside the walls of a university. So I work with the DIY bio community. Actually, 2 weekends ago, we had one of the first global community bio summits, where there was about 200 of us from across the globe at the Media Lab, actually. There are now kits that you can order online to do some of this work at a community biotech lab or even in your home if you want. And I think, for me, I think that that's great, that more people are sort of having access to science and access to these types of technologies. At the same time, I think there needs to be, you know, the right sort of codes of conduct, in a sense, of people taking the responsibility or understanding the responsibility of the power of some of these technologies and what it means to be able to use them. Just because you have a CRISPR kit that you ordered online does not mean that you're going to be able to create a gene drive in a mouse and release it into the environment. But to get to your question of how CRISPR time is different, I'll give you an example from the iGEM competition, which is the International Genetically Engineered Machines Competition, which I sit on the Human Practices Committee and also the Biosafety Committees for that. So last year, 2016, gene drives had sort of been in the lexicon for 2 years about. So we at iGEM sort of were not thinking about whether we needed to have sort of a real kind of protocol or any special rules around gene drives, because we were like, it's we don't have to worry about it right now. It's too soon. And lo and behold, a team from Minnesota showed up who had attempted to, in essence, create a gene drive. They weren't successful, but it sort of opened our eyes up to this, in essence, sort of CRISPR time in terms of how quickly the pace of change is happening in these technologies. And how accessible they are, which I think, you know, begs this question again about, like, how is we as society want to sort of either utilize these technologies? How do we not want to utilize these technologies? And what kind of governance mechanisms do we want to have in place moving forward?
My question builds a little bit on...
Please introduce yourself. Sorry.
I don't know how to restate that question. You asked you. Sorry, it's a long. Should we be? You know, how much should we be? Are we thinking about the ethics of all this? And also, the other part of the question was: should we be spending time and energy on fixing these problems when we created, rather than doing mitigation? Right. To answer the second question first, I mean, I think that both of those things can kind of happen at the same time. I don't think that necessarily there's this pool of money that if you do mitigation, it's going to not go towards these technologies and vice versa. They're kind of separate pots from how I would guess those are divvied up. As far as wrestling with the ethics and everything, I guess I see my job as a journalist as reporting on what's happening and including those ethical conversations in the stories that I'm writing and making sure that there's that dimension to the story, but not necessarily trying not to put my own view on these technologies and be more agnostic about the technologies myself, if that answers your question. So I think as journalists, it's important for us to include that in our conversations and our writing, but not necessarily try and put our own value on these technologies.
Yeah, the way that I think about this is I hate that we have to have this conversation. I hate that Kevin has to develop a gene drive to solve a conservation problem, because we've lost, right? We have failed in terms of, I would argue, our responsibilities in terms of preserving nature, that we have to sort of now look towards this kind of solution in order to solve some of those problems. I can wish all I want that we change humans' behaviors, but there's no evidence that that has happened or that it will happen. And so I think, unfortunately, from my perspective anyway, is if this is a tool that might look like it could be a solution, it's certainly not a silver bullet solution, and it still is going to be part of a larger combination of tools that we have to use, including still, behavioral changes, but it's a tool I think that we can't just ignore because it makes us uncomfortable if our goal is to actually solve some of these conservation problems.
The newest grad student in my lab asked a very similar question, and she said, but her response was, is there any species that we could target with the gene drive to increase carbon uptake and therefore fixation in order to directly address climate change by engineering the ecosphere to do that? I've thought about it. there aren't any obvious really good candidates, but she at least will keep looking. More generally, you have to do what you can with the tools that you have. And in this case, climate change makes everybody's problems harder. But if we screw up and fall due to something else, that's not going to help anybody either us or necessarily the natural world, because then we'd be climbing up to civilization again, in all likelihood, with having already damaged the planet. So we are already at the point where we have used technology so much that we are utterly and completely dependent upon continued advances. And so I think, so for me, I've decided that the most important thing that I can do is try to change the system by which we develop technology so that we are more likely to choose whether or not to use it with some manner of wisdom.
Is all of this research also happening with plants too? Because when you just think about carbon, like wetlands, for example, are huge carbon sinks. Are there people who are researching how CRISPR can be used in plants and non-animal?
Yeah, so is CRISPR being used in plants? Yeah, so there's a ton of work on... So plants always runs a little bit behind animals just because anthropomorphism and scientists, I assume. There's definitely a lot of efforts to use CRISPR in plants for improving crops and the like. There's, in particular, a lot of efforts to make C4 crops, C4 rice, among other things. And there's even a number of researchers who... So I find this somewhat disappointing. They're trying to re-engineer photosynthesis from scratch, because evolution sort of got backed into a corner with Rubisco and some suboptimal design decisions, one might say, and can't necessarily escape that trap, but they're hoping that they can sort of rationally design their way out to a much more efficient version of carbon fixation. Problem with that is you put that in a plant and let it out there, and that's a heck of a fitness advantage. After all, just because we never come up with anything before that was advantageous in the ancestral habitat, that is one thing that absolutely would. And so that species would then have probably become very invasive around the world, which is almost never anything that those scientists seem to have considered, which is another example of why I think we need to have these discussions before we start developing these technologies, because these tend to be, you know, molecular biologists and biochemists rather than ecologists, and so the ecological consequences don't necessarily come up. As for plant gene drive, I'm not aware of anyone looking at that at all. Plants are highly resistant because gene drives basically does not work unless the organism is exclusively sexually reproducing. If it can do any other form of reproduction, it can escape. Can and will, according to the simulations. So I'm not aware of anything in that direction, but there are some species that are obligate outcrossers that you could potentially hit with a gene drive for one reason or another. Right now, just to give you a general idea of what species people are looking at for gene drives, most of the work is on mosquitoes. Anopheles gambiae, malarial mosquito, Stevensi is a secondary minor vector, easy to work with. Aedes aegypti carries dengue, chikungunya, Zika, yellow fever, etc. We're looking at Culex cunce fasciatus, which carries avian malaria that's wiping out the native birds in Hawaii. Mice, rats, not black rats yet, just brown rats, because they're the model. There's people working in zebrafish. There's people working in... we're doing nematodes, as I said, a couple of different species. And I think that's currently all in terms of active projects that I'm aware of. And you'll note that some of those, there probably hasn't been any media mention of them, for which I am obviously deeply disappointed and continue to make a pest of myself, telling my colleagues that they should be a little bit more open about what they're doing. But that's all, and I'm not aware of any plants on the list.
I would just add, I cover agriculture a lot. The only gene drives I know of have nothing to do with plants also, but I know there's some projects with certain fruit flies that are agricultural pests that people are looking at. As far as using CRISPR in plants, I mean, companies are definitely looking at using CRISPR all over the place, and scientists are also using it in the lab, doing everything from trying to make disease-resistant crops to doing more of the same of what we've seen, making crops that are, you know, tolerant to herbicides, that kind of thing. One thing that we probably will see in terms of trends in agriculture for plants for CRISPR is, because it is relatively easier and cheaper than the previous technologies, we're going to see it in more in different types of crops and probably in smaller companies that can afford to do this kind of research. You may see it a little bit more in the fruit markets and vegetables and that kind of thing, not just those big crops like corn and soy. And I could probably say a lot more about agriculture and CRISPR because I've been writing about it a lot over the years, but I'll end it at that.
And how do you
So what should early conversations look like? Who should the stakeholders be? How do you organize it? Great questions, and I think the answer is going to differ depending on what it is. But unless the experiments are, the term I use is pre-registered, that is, I think that we should be detailing exactly what we intend to build in which organism and why before we actually run the experiments. And when we first described CRISPR-based gene drive technology, we did so before we ever tested in the lab. We got a lot of flack from that from other scientists, but we wanted to set this precedent of you don't mess around with something like this without telling people. Because if your organism can fly out of the lab and affect other people, I'm not sure you have the right to do that work behind closed doors. Never mind that I don't really see why science should be behind closed doors in the first place unless we believe it is something that actually would be dangerous, so dangerous that you can't even tell people what the idea is. So I'm not a total transparency zealot because there are some things that are dangerous enough that we shouldn't be sharing them around, obviously. But that, in general, I think we're more likely to make a wise decision if the information is out there to have that discussion. But I don't have any special insight as to what form that should take. And on Nantucket, we just have town hall meetings, and that's great. And New Zealand now, that's a little more challenging. It's a bit bigger. And once you're talking the whole world, I don't know, how are we going to talk, not to bring up the really potentially taboo subject here, but how are we going to talk about geoengineering? We can't even talk about a gene drive that would affect a few nations.
Some would argue gene drives are geoengineering.
In routes.
That would be one of them. just to follow up on that, the G-Bird program, which NC State is a part of with Island Conservation, where, you know, part of that is doing this public engagement and trying to figure out what this looks like, because Kevin's right. I think it looks different depending on, one, what the application is and also where you're planning on doing it. So one of the questions, that we've been asking is, what if there's no people on the island that you're trying to do this on? A lot of these islands that particularly Island Conservation is interested in, there's no people on it. Who do I talk to about that? Right? Is it the next closest population location? Is it everyone? Is it a private island? Is it a public island? Is it an island owned by an environmental organization, for instance, or is it a country's island? These, I think, are all active questions that those of us who are interested in this openness and interested in having these larger societal conversations that I think we struggle with, because you can't talk to everybody. It's just practically impossible. So I think we're trying to figure out what that overall system looks like in terms of what is this pathway to yes or no? And that's the way that we like to frame this, is that the decision has not been made, and we want to have the conversation to figure out whether it's yes or whether it's no. And to make sure that scientists like Kevin, who's, I think, has been a leader in this, has said, if the answer is no, then the answer is no, and I'll move on to something else, which is, you do not hear that much, if ever, particularly from people in the scientific and technology worlds. So it's refreshing, and I think needs to be applauded, and there needs to be more people like Kevin out there in these types of technologies that are willing to take that risk of having those conversations at this stage of research and even before anything starts, and are willing to take no as an answer. But we don't have a good model yet of how to really do that. We're all kind of just trying it out and seeing if any of it works, I think.
I just wanted to add to that, for that piece I mentioned that's in Scientific American right now that I wrote. This not only is this different depending on the project, the different groups that I wrote about they're instituting these outreach programs at different parts and different points in their research. It's kind of all over the board. I also wanted to mention that the funding agencies, we talked about DARPA, for example, when they did their call for projects for Safe Genes, having an outreach component was actually, my understanding, a requirement for the people applying for that funding. So it's getting built in even at that level in this type of research.
Journalists should be asking you that
I'll start. So the question is, what kind of questions should journals be asking people like Kevin, I think? One question that I think is, right? One question I think that gets overlooked or is not followed up with enough is where we actually are in the development of the technology. I think too often the stories that I read make it sound like NC State has a mouse ready to go, right? And we are way far away from that. And so I think journalists need to follow up with scientists who, in a lot of instances, are trying to sell their ideas because they want to make it look like it's exciting and they believe in it and they think it's going to work. But to really ground the story in where the science actually is right now, which is very much at the lab scale. And I think that has gotten lost over time, particularly in CRISPR time, and how quickly CRISPR came on. And all of a sudden, you hear a lot of times, too, I read in stories, you read CRISPR and it equals a gene drive, and that's not true either. And so I think if there's a way for journalists to kind of nail scientists down a little more about, okay, well, how far along actually is this? Like, what have you actually been able to accomplish and show in actual experiments, not in models? Models are good for a lot of things, but they're also still just models. So that's what I would have to say about that.
You still see very strong public resistance to any sort of tinkering with, Bounty salmon that just started going for sale in Canada and anything to do with GMO. Like, GMO technology is super old compared to all this stuff. And still, massive public debates over whether it's safe, whether it's ethical, whether it's anything. And then I feel like the fact that CRISPR and all these things have been able to continue at the pace they've been going is because it's still mostly in the corner. Like, most people haven't heard of it. If they did, they'd be free. How does the future public perception of these sorts of technologies, not in Scientific American, like time, right? How does that, addressing those future concerns, guide what you do now? Like, are you preparing for that sort of pushback? Or is it limiting the choices that you're making?
So the question concerns the extent to which there is still controversy over GMOs and how most GM crops are, frankly, they were made using technology that was around when I was in elementary school. And those are the ones that people are still arguing over, which is sort of, yeah. So how are we going to deal with the potential for future public perception backlash? First of all, it's not set in stone. And people care more about how it's developed and by whom and why than they do about the actual class of technology. And I know this because on Nantucket and the Vineyard, there are people who don't eat GM foods and don't even vaccinate their children who have come to us and said, so when you do have the mice, can we have some and start breeding them on our own property so that we can release them sooner and be first? These are engineered mice, right? Engineered wild mice. And, like, the whole idea is release 100,000 engineered mice on the island. If the communities want to do this, then they have to vote in favor. And the vote will probably be a good 6-7 years away at least if everything goes right in the lab. But they're not afraid of it in the same sort of way. And I don't know exactly why. Maybe that's, why that versus the Florida Keys. Is that because we're nonprofit and we went to them first and said, you're in charge? Is that because 40% of people in Nantucket have been affected by tick-borne disease, whereas the Keys hadn't had a case of dengue for some number of years? Is it some combination thereof? I don't know. But in the case of gene drive, it all depends on what comes first. Do we actually solve an obvious problem, that is one that's obvious to the typical person on the street, with the technology first? Or does some fool accidentally or deliberately release one that will effectively turn an entire wild species into GMOs? And if it's the latter, then what we've seen so far with GM foods is not going to look like all that much of a fracas.
I would just add that a lot of the scientists that I have interviewed, one of the elements of putting out these sort of public outreach programs so early in this research in part is a reaction to that big reaction against GMOs, right? It's like, we don't want to make that mistake again. So that's part of why that's happening. Not the only reason, but part of why that's happening now too.
We have time for one more question. Robin, it is. Do you
want to
fight it out?
I've got two, though.
Is there anyone who hasn't asked a question yet that would like to?
So the question is, aren't we trying to solve problems in an environment that is constantly changing? And so why do that when it's just going to change on us again? And I think this is very important when it comes to the use of these technologies for conservation, because if it can only solve the problem that's there right now, say the particular invasive population there, then what happens if you get a stowaway on another ship and then it reinvades? Can you do it again? Because you're probably going to have to do it again in a lot of cases. So this is so like the standard version I mentioned, it's possible. It's like island conservation is looking into targeting particular invasive populations, hoping that there's a unique set of mutations they already have because the founders had that really isn't found elsewhere in the world that would let them narrowly target just that invasive population. But the problem with that is if you get a reinvasion, your drive system isn't going to work anymore. You'd have to build an entirely new one from scratch. You'd have to build a different one for population by population, which is, you know, again, part of why we're looking at DAISY as a potential alternative. But it may be that even DAISY has problems, or you know, we're likely to invent something else. But I do think that we need to assume that it needs to be flexible. And in the case of invasive species removal especially, you have to assume that someone's going to bring them back. In fact, my default assumption is, I don't care if cane toads don't naturally travel on cargo ships between Australia and South America. My default assumption is to assume that think about how many trolls there are on the internet. Not everyone who's a troll on the internet is a troll in real life, but my default assumption is that people will move it. Whatever I build, I assume that there is someone who wants to even break into the laboratory and move that somewhere, illegally, without permission. Just because you have to assume that. Like, that's just baseline caution. So I think we do need to assume that everything will change and try to develop these things in as open, safe, and flexible a manner as we can in order to address these issues. And it's also worth noting that in the case of invasive species removal, the nice bit is we're not actually altering a population forever. In fact, the goal is you would release the DAISY suppression drive organisms and onto the island, and then the DAISY drive would spread, fertility would plummet, then you wouldn't have a next generation, and then you wouldn't have any engineered DNA either. The population would just be gone. Now, I say that just because many people care about engineered DNA. I don't, because cows are 25% snake. Because a gene drive a couple million years ago hitched a ride, probably on a tick-borne virus, into the auroch germline at the time and replicated until it's 25% of the cow genome. So cows are 25% snake. Who cares about foreign DNA? But some people do, and it's their environment, and they're making the decision. So, yeah.
All right. That is all of our time for today. Thank you, everyone. I was instructed to tell you to please go to the ballroom for the membership meeting, and there are also refreshments there.